Hello, and welcome to the Spring 2010 podcast for the journal Pediatric Physical Therapy. I'm Donovan Stutel. This month, part two of the updated practice guidelines for neonatal physical therapy, a focus on pain in children and adolescents with cerebral palsy, and more. This podcast is brought to you by the Section on Pediatrics of the American Physical Therapy Association. The section seeks to promote the highest quality of life for all children, people with developmental disabilities, and their families. First this month, here is editor Anne Van Sant with her editorial, The Challenge of Pain in Children and Adolescents with Cerebral Palsy.
An important report by Doral and Bartlett appears in this issue that documents the prevalence of pain in adolescents with cerebral palsy. This is not the first time attention has been brought to this problem. Yet with the data in hand from the work of Doral and Bartlett, I believe that it's time to get serious about what our roles might be with respect to pain in this population. In this issue, we also have a review article by Swigum and her colleagues who outline an approach to the treatment of pain in children with CP. Their recommendations should provide some tools for therapists who do not routinely intervene to reduce pain in their young patients. The thought that so many children with CP are seen by therapists who are trained to treat painful conditions raises the question, do we ask children and teens with CP whether they are experiencing pain? I would suggest that some may, but do we do this routinely? Developmental and functional tests are routine, as are tests to detect well-recognized impairments in range of motion, strength, and balance. I believe that it is time to determine whether children under our care are experiencing pain, and if so, we should begin to address pain as routinely as we might address weakness. As Doral and Bartlett point out, in some instances, pain can be prevented. However, I would suggest that we begin to examine in greater detail the mechanisms that lead to painful joints. Are the common postural malalignments and reduced movement repertoires leading to overuse and contributing to the development of pain? Or is inactivity a culprit? Likely, both scenarios are operative in young persons with CP. With a better understanding of what leads to the development of pain, we can begin to prevent the development of pain as a secondary complication of an already complex disabling condition in children. Although I am sure that we can routinely begin to address pain in our examinations and interventions, ideally, we need to prevent this secondary impairment before it begins to affect the quality of our patients' lives.
Next, a special communication. Neonatal Physical Therapy, Part 2, Practice Frameworks and Evidence-Based Practice Guidelines, by Jane Sweeney of both Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah, and Pediatric Rehab Northwest in Gig Harbor, Washington, and Carolyn Horiza, Yvette Blanchard, and Stacy Dusing. The purposes of this paper were, 1, to outline frameworks for neonatal physical therapy based on 3 theoretical models, 2, to describe emerging literature supporting neonatal physical therapy practice, and 3, to identify evidence-based practice recommendations. 3 models are presented as a framework for neonatal practice. 1. Dynamic systems theory, including synaptive theory and the theory of neuronal group selection. 2. The International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health. And 3. Family-centered care. Literature is summarized to support neonatal physical therapists in the areas of examination, developmental care, intervention, and parent education. Practice recommendations are offered with levels of evidence identified. The authors conclude that neonatal physical therapy practice has a theoretical and evidence-based structure, and evidence is emerging for selected clinical procedures. Continued research to expand the science of neonatal physical therapy is critical to elevate the evidence and support practice recommendations. That was Neonatal Physical Therapy, Part 2, Practice Frameworks and Evidence-Based Practice Guidelines, by Sweeney et al. And joining us now to discuss this paper are authors Jane Sweeney and Carolyn Horiza. Jane, Carolyn, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting us. We're pleased to be here to talk about one of our favorite topics.
That's great. So first, I'd like to ask you about how things have changed over the last 10 years since the last time a guidelines paper was published. What has changed with the theoretical framework and also the evidence base for neonatal ICU physical therapy care?
Carolyn, why don't you take that one on, the theoretical framework particularly?
Okay, I think in relationship to the framework, the dynamic systems theory, which is, you know, one of the frameworks that we presented, has been expanded. And so it now includes examples of the dynamic systems theory with two other theories that have been developed perhaps somewhat around the same time or slightly later than our first article came out. These are the synactive theory, which is a theory related to the neonate in the NICU that was developed by Dr. Alls in relationship to how does a baby who's born early respond to this external environment. And it fits nicely into the concept of the dynamic systems theory. And the other one is the theory of neuronal group selection, which is looking at how the brain develops. And it also fits in nicely with a systems theory. And it also has now some evidence behind it, at least in animal models, and in one study by Heidi Alls with infants born preterm. In addition, we added some concepts of neuroplasticity. There's just been a tremendous amount of research, so you talked just a little bit about the neuroplasticity. One of the other frameworks, which is the International Classification of Functioning Disability in Health, the ICF, it was work in progress 10 years ago, and so we did include some of the language and some of the concepts back then, but it has now been approved. So all of that was changed to reflect the current classification system.
And one of the pillars of evidence-based practice is the patient perspective, and that seems to be filled by the role of family-centered care that you talk about.
That's right. And this family-centered care has caused tremendous, wonderful changes in procedures in neonatal units over the last 10 to 20 years when before that it was mostly infant-focused. It became family-centered 1 to 2 weeks before discharge when all the efforts were focused on preparing the family to take the baby home and learning about the home environment and the resources needed at that point. But now, really, all of our neonatal units are working at including the family in caregiving practices, decision-making, and procedures as soon as they're able from the time of admission. Our practice guidelines then have family-centered care as one of the pillars. It's really been interesting in the last 10 years, for example, to see not only are families able to visit anytime in a 24-hour period and bring their children and the grandparents, but also now there are architectural advances for new buildings and for retrofitting current hospital structures to offer individual family caregiving and living space in intensive care and intermediate care units. Instead of the hospital bays where perhaps four infants might reside together in a hospital-type traditional setting. So I think that the family-centered care is really taking off not only in our practices, but also in the architecture of hospitals to support these efforts.
That's a fascinating addition, that they're actually changing the design of the physical building.
Right.
So on to the evidence. What is some of the new evidence that has come out in the last 10 years?
Maybe both of us can talk with this, Jane. When the first article was written, there really wasn't much evidence available in the literature to support or not support the neonatal physical therapist role in the NICU. So now there is evidence for both prevention, examination, intervention, as well as the caregiver education. And most of the evidence that's been published is primarily at a recommendation according to the Oxford Center of a grade B, like small randomized control studies, as well as systematic reviews, level 2 and 3 are where the majority of the evidence is. I think we've gone from having none to having some sophisticated articles and evidence-based research to support this. from my perspective, I think another area that needs to be addressed is specific interventions that the physical therapist might provide within the NICU. A lot of the literature that's out there and the evidence that's out there is a variety of different evidence from different professionals. Some physical therapists, physicians, psychologists, etc. And so I think we as physical therapists have a lot to offer in what we do in the NICU. So I would like to see more of that being published by a physical therapy profession.
I completely concur with that, and we're hoping that as physical therapists and others look over these practice guidelines and look at where we are starting to document the evidence, that they could see areas where they could pull together perhaps their neonatal team to look at certain clinical questions that need answering and continue to work with all of us to expand our evidence, because that's the next step of these practice guidelines, is to build and expand the evidence for our practice in neonatal physical therapy.
Jane, Carolyn, thank you both for your time today.
Thank you,
Donovan. Thank you.
Jane Sweeney and Carolyn Hariza are both professors at Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah. Jane Sweeney also is the owner of Pediatric Rehab Northwest LLC in Gig Harbor, Washington. The Effects of Age and Gender on the Weight and Use of School Bags, by Eleftherios Kellis and Maria Emanoilidou, both of Aristotle University of Thessaloniki, in Serres, Greece. The purpose of this study was to examine age and gender differences in school bag use, and to compare findings in Greece with those of other countries. School bag weight and carrying characteristics were assessed in 703 boys and girls aged 6 to 14 years. Multinomial logistic regression models showed that younger students, 6 to 8 years of age, were almost 5 times more likely to carry heavier school bags than older students. Similarly, more girls than boys carried heavier bags, and girls were 2 times more likely to experience fatigue symptoms when carrying school bags compared with boys. The mean school bag weight was 12.4% of the student's body weight, and moderately heavier than that reported for other countries. The authors conclude that younger children are in greater need for education about school bag weight compared with older ones. There is also evidence that girls might experience more problems when carrying their school bag compared with boys. That was The Effects of Age and Gender on the Weight and Use of School Bags, by Kellis and Emanoilidou. Next, the prevalence, distribution, and effect of pain among adolescents with cerebral palsy, by Samantha Doralp and Doreen Bartlett, both of the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, Canada. The purpose of this study was to describe the prevalence, distribution, and intensity of pain and determine the relationship between pain intensity and effect on daily activities in adolescents with cerebral palsy. A sample of 104 girls, mean age 14.7 years, and 126 boys, mean age 14.8 years, were asked the question, "Have you experienced physical pain in the past month?" 64% of girls and 50% of boys reported pain. Pain was most frequent in the feet and ankles, knees, and lower back of girls and boys at gross motor function classification system levels 1 to 4. Foot and ankle and knee pain were also frequent at gross motor function classification system level 5. There was a significant relationship between pain intensity and effect on daily activities. The Spearman-Rowe value between intensity and effect on daily activities was 0.75 for girls and 0.82 for boys. The authors conclude that the high prevalence of pain and its effect on daily activities suggests a need for greater focus on health promotion. That was The Prevalence, Distribution, and Effect of Pain Among Adolescents with Cerebral Palsy, by Doralp and Bartlett. Next, frontal and sagittal plane biomechanics during drop-jump landing in boys who are obese. By Amy Gross McMillan, Callie Phillips, David Collier, and D.S. Blaze Williams, all of East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. The purpose of this study was to investigate the frontal and sagittal plane lower extremity biomechanics during drop-jump landings in boys who were obese and boys who were of healthy weight. 12 boys participated. 6 were considered as healthy weight, with a body mass index for age less than 85%, and 6 were considered obese, with a body mass index for age greater than 95%. The average ages of the boys in the two groups were 11 and 12 years, respectively. Three-dimensional data were collected during landing from a drop jump. Group means were compared using student t-tests. Significant differences were found in peak hip adduction moment, timing of peak dorsiflexion and knee flexion angles, and timing of peak knee extension and abduction moments. The authors conclude that boys who were obese exhibited significant differences in frontal and sagittal plane biomechanics when landing from a jump compared with healthy weight peers. These differences could place boys who are obese at greater risk for lower extremity injuries when they engage in jump landing activities. That was frontal and sagittal plane biomechanics during drop jump landing in boys who are obese by McMillan et al. Next, Measuring Function in Young Children with Impairments, by Paulette Nuzik and Carl Granger, both of the University at Buffalo, in Buffalo, New York. The purpose of this study was to determine the psychometric properties of a new functional assessment tool, the WE-FIM 0-3 instrument, intended to measure function in young children with physical, cognitive, or developmental impairments from birth to 3 years of age. Specific aims were to determine whether differences exist in WE-FIM 0-3 ratings in children with impairments as compared with those without, controlling for age and gender, and to determine the internal consistency, validity, and hierarchical properties of the instrument. This was a cross-sectional study of 173 children with impairments and 354 children without impairments. Controlling for age, children without impairments had significantly higher mean WE-FIM 0-3 ratings than children with impairments. There were no differences in mean ratings by gender. The instrument displayed high internal consistency, construct and predictive validity, maintained a hierarchy of item difficulty, and displayed discriminant properties. Further reliability studies are needed to determine the instrument sensitivity and ability to detect change over time. That was Measuring Function in Young Children with Impairments, by Nuzik and Granger. This article is the subject of this month's Clinical Bottom Line. Joining us now is one of the authors of the Clinical Bottom Line, Carol Tucker. Welcome, Carol.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First, how should pediatric physical therapists apply the information from this article?
Well, the information presented in the article is concerning a new instrument, the WE-FIM 0-3 instrument, and that's meant to measure pre-functional status in really young kids, 0-3 years of age. Most of the measures for 0-3-year-old infants actually focus on developmental status, and that's what we're used to seeing as pediatric physical therapists. The WE-FIM approach is that there's certain pre-functional motor tasks children need to do that will feed into function as they age. So they've chosen a set of items that look at pre-function, and the way you would apply this information is if you're in a pediatric rehab setting, this may be of use to you in measuring pre-functional skills in children in this age range.
And what should pediatric physical therapists be mindful about when applying this information?
So if you're looking at an instrument like this, one of the first things I'd recommend doing is, even if it says it's to measure pre-functional skills and they describe what the purpose of the instrument is, always go to the list of the items or the questions, or if it's a survey instrument, whatever they're actually asking or looking at for the children or the parent to report or do. And this is really important. When I look through the set of items that are listed as pre-functional skills, many of them do appear as developmental motor skills on other measures. So even though this is labeled pre-function, within their motor skill, there's going to be a lot of overlap with other existing measures of developmental status. And that may just be important to note that sometimes the way an instrument is portrayed is very similar to the way it's titled, but the items, looking at the grouping of the items, is really what informs you as to what it's measuring. So when you look at this, you can see there's some overlap. There's some different domains. This is given as a self-report measure, where the other FIM measures are typically given as an interview. So there's some slight differences between this measure and others, which is good news because it means this measure may fill a niche that you need an instrument for. The other big component about how to apply this information, what really excites me about the approach that they use, is they've applied item response theory analyses, which, unlike traditional statistical approaches in how we look at instruments, really is a great way of developing the instruments because you can see how the items fit together and how well they measure the construct, in this case, pre-function abilities, in the instrument. One of the interesting things about doing item response theory, and in this case, they used a type of item response theory called RASH analysis, is that you get maps called Wright maps, and the Wright map is named after a famous IRT statistician, Benjamin Wright. When you look at Figure 1 in this article, what's really neat about it is that both the items, in order of their difficulty, fall along the same ruler. So as you look at the scale of this figure, what you can see is where the items range in difficulty. And that's an interval scale. It's actually the difference between where those items fall is actually the difference in difficulty between them. The other neat thing is if you look at where the people are, you can see how the people are distributed relative to where the items are. So are there items clustered where there are people? That means that instrument can really measure well where there's a lot of people. You're going to see a lot of these Wright maps in the articles that look at item response theory. And I would encourage everyone to really start looking at them because they can be really informative to practice. So I'm really excited. I would encourage all of us as pediatric practitioners to go out and start learning more about these modern measurement approaches to instrument development like IRT analysis. And you see that related to factor analysis. So the fact that this is emerging within our literature, I think, is going to be a really important point.
That was the clinical bottom line for the article, Measuring Function in Young Children with Impairments. The clinical bottom line was written by Carol Tucker and Kyle Watson, both of Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Next, motor development toward ambulation in preschool children with myelomeningocele, a prospective study, by Åsa Bartonek of the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. The purpose of this study was to describe motor development toward ambulation in children with myelomeningocele. 43 children were followed prospectively from 6 months to 6 years of age. The author found walking function had been achieved at the one-year follow-up in 2 of 38 children, at the one-and-a-half-year follow-up in 7 of 39, at the two-year follow-up in 14 of 36, at the three-year follow-up in 21 of 28, at the four-year follow-up in 28 of 36, and at the six-year follow-up in 30 of 38. At the six-year follow-up, spasticity was present in 22 of 38 children. 42 of 43 used orthoses, and 9 children had not achieved ambulation expected with respect to muscle function. The author concludes that in children with myelomeningocele, walking starts in some during the first year of life and is seen increasingly more frequently until 6 years of age. Motor development before ambulation varies among children with similar muscle function. An increased incidence of spasticity is found among those not having achieved ambulation with respect to muscle function. That was Motor Development Toward Ambulation in Preschool Children with Myelomeningocele, a Prospective Study, by Bartonek. treadmill responses and physical activity levels of infants at risk for neuromotor delay by Rosa Angulo Barossa, Chad Tiernan, Li Chu Chen, Dale Ulrich, and Heather Neary, all of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This study describes developmental changes in treadmill stepping and physical activity of infants at risk for neuromotor delay and explored these changes by diagnosis of cerebral palsy. Relationships of stepping and physical activity with walking onset were examined. 15 infants at risk for neuromotor delay, average age 10 months, were tested every 2 months on a treadmill until walking onset or 24 months of corrected age. The authors recorded physical activity profiles using an activity monitor. Throughout the study, 6 of the 15 infants received a cerebral palsy diagnosis. Infants increased alternating steps, decreased toe contacts, and increased high-level physical activity. Infants with cerebral palsy showed fewer alternating steps, more toe contacts, and less high-level physical activity than those without cerebral palsy. Infants alternating steps and high-level physical activity revealed a positive correlation to earlier onset of walking. Future studies should examine whether a treadmill intervention could improve mobility in infants at risk for neuromotor delay. That was Treadmill Responses and Physical Activity Levels of Infants at Risk for Neuromotor Delay by Angulo Barossa et al. Next, lessons from use of the Pediatric Evaluation of Disability Inventory. Where do we go from here? By Stephen Haley of Boston University School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts, and 7 others. The purpose of this article is to review the innovations, applications, and effect of the original Pediatric Evaluation of Disability Inventory, PEDI, published in 1992, and to describe planned revisions. During the past decade, the PEDI has helped to shift thinking from a developmental to a functional focus. Using the PEDI, researchers and clinicians worldwide have highlighted variations in functional skill acquisition in clinical populations, the importance of recognizing cultural differences, and the value of documenting functional progress in relation to interventions. The PEDI has had a rich tradition in helping to document functional development. New methods are proposed for the next generation of the PEDI by using item banks and computer adaptive testing. The computer adaptive testing feature and the revised and expanded content of the new PEDI will enable therapists to more efficiently assess children's functioning to a broader age group of children. That was Lessons from Use of the Pediatric Evaluation of Disability Inventory. Where do we go from here? By Haley et al. Next, changes in 2 children with cerebral palsy after intensive suit therapy. A case report. By Amy Bales of Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Kelly Grieve and Laura Schmidt. The purpose of this case report was to investigate effects of intensive suit therapy on gait, functional skills, caregiver assistance, and gross motor ability in children with cerebral palsy. The subjects were 2 children with spastic diplegic cerebral palsy classified at level 3 on the gross motor function classification system. Outcomes were assessed using dimensions D and E of the gross motor function measure, the Pediatric Evaluation of Disability Inventory, and instrumented gait analysis. Each child participated in the Therasuit method, 4 hours per day, 5 days per week, for 3 weeks. Very small improvements in function were noted in dimension D of the gross motor function measure and Pediatric Evaluation of Disability Inventory self-care domain, with decreased function in other areas. Improved walking speed, cadence, symmetry, joint motion, and posture were found with gait analysis. The authors conclude that further investigation is needed of the suit itself and intensive therapy programs in children with cerebral palsy. That was Changes in 2 Children with Cerebral Palsy After Intensive Suit Therapy, a case report, by Bales, Grieve, and Schmidt. Finally this month, a review article. Pain in Children with Cerebral Palsy, Implications for Pediatric Physical Therapy, by Mary Swigum, Mary Lynn Hamilton, Peggy Gleason, and Tony Roddy, all of Texas Women's University in Houston, Texas. This literature review explores pain assessment tools and psychosocial pain management methods that are pertinent to physical therapy for children with cerebral palsy. Children with cerebral palsy experience considerable pain that affects quality of life and cooperation during healthcare procedures. Physical therapist-led research on interventions to address pain in this population is limited, despite evidence for the prevalence of pain during physical therapy interventions and the preponderance of research supporting the use of psychosocial pain management during other healthcare-related pain-inducing procedures. Research completed primarily by non-physical therapist healthcare professionals delineate assessment tools and psychosocial pain management techniques that hold promise for evaluating and reducing pain that occurs during physical therapy procedures for children with cerebral palsy. That was Pain in Children with Cerebral Palsy: Implications for Pediatric Physical Therapy by Swigum et al. Thanks for listening. This podcast is a production of Science Audio, online at www.scienceaudio.net. Please send your comments or questions to PEDPT, that's PEDPT, at scienceaudio.net. Get the full text of all pediatric physical therapy articles online at www.pedpt.com.